You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Yeah, I am a scientist. Yeah, I am a scientist. Yeah, I am a scientist. We gotta live on science alone.
Welcome to Unbiased Science, where we bring scientific method to the madness. I'm your host and public health scientist, Dr. Jess Steyer. And today I am so excited to let you know that we are joined by Dr. Karen Tang. I'm going to introduce Karen and then we're going to get into it. We have so much to chat about today. Dr. Tang is a board certified gynecologist, minimally invasive gynecologic surgeon, and the author of It's Not Hysteria. Everything you need to know about your reproductive health, but were never told. And we'll talk about this in a minute. We'll talk more about the book, but it is available now for pre-order. We will link to it in the show notes. You can also follow her at Karen Tang MD on TikTok, on Instagram, and on YouTube, where she reaches millions of viewers across the world each month with her educational videos about sexual and reproductive health. Her goal is to break down the stigma and misinformation around these issues, empower people to understand their own bodies, and take control of their health. Karen, thank you so much for joining me today.
I'm so excited. I cannot wait to dive into all the juicy topics that we're going to be covering today.
So the overarching topic is that we want to dispel certain myths and misconceptions about women's health. We're going to kick things off with a conversation specifically about endometriosis. Karen actually informed me that this month is Endometriosis Awareness Month. Is that right, Karen?
That's right. Yeah.
There you go. But we also have a ton of other myths and misconceptions that we're going to get through. Before we do that, Karen, can you give us a little insight into what your book is about, where folks can find it and order it?
Absolutely. So It's Not Hysteria is a book that came about because of things that I had heard just in the process of being a gynecologist for 15 years, being on social media and hearing stories from people who had gone many times, years and years, with so many health issues, you know, pelvic pain, bleeding issues with their periods, menopause symptoms, fertility concerns, and just not getting their concerns taken seriously or even outright dismissed. And then later finding out that, oh my gosh, I had endometriosis, fibroids, PCOS, it was perimenopause, things that are just common conditions, but somehow were being missed. And, you know, there's so many things we could talk about why that is, you know, bigger kind of social issues. So, you know, I wanted to write a book that did a couple of things. One was to kind of take a little bit of a deep dive into why that is. I personally love history. So I start in the beginning of it, you know, like, how did this happen? How is it that, you know, women are half the population? How is it that we've gotten to this point where our health concerns are so misunderstood and mismanaged? So kind of taking a little deep dive into that. But most of the book is about each of these topics. So there's literally a chapter on, you know, basic sex ed, endometriosis, fibroids, the pelvic floor, the vulva, the vagina, sexual issues, you know, and including other topics which are obviously in the news all the time now, like abortion, gender affirming care, birth control. So all of these topics that anyone probably at some point has had questions about or has had problems with, you know, if you poll pretty much anyone, they've had issues with some of these things, but had no idea kind of where to find reliable information. And oftentimes they may not get that from their doctor, their parents, their friends. So I wanted to have a good resource for people to have all that. And then it also, it's not just sort of like, you know, like a textbook. It's also about how can you empower yourself? So there's chapters on, you know, kind of assessing what your own experiences are. Like, what are you going through? Like, what symptoms are you worried about? And then also a chapter at the end about, like, you know, what's important to you? Like, there's no right or wrong treatment path for every single person. It's all about an individual and kind of what your goals are. So basically, you know, what's important to you? Like, how do you feel about medications, hormones, surgery, you know, that sort of thing. And so it's supposed to be kind of like an all-in-one guide to basically all the stuff that you should know. That's the subtitle. You know, you should have learned this, but you never did. But also how to take that into your life and make some changes and help advocate for yourself. And you can pre-order it basically anywhere you can get books. So we'll have a link to the main publisher websites It has basically links to all the big retailers, but please do just request it at your local independent bookstore or your libraries. That's super helpful. It shows them that there's an interest in these things, and that really helps the booksellers and the librarians know that this is something that they can recommend to other readers as well.
Karen, first and foremost, congratulations. This is amazing. And thank you so much, because there clearly is, unfortunately, such a need for this. If you are watching this on YouTube, we're going to drop a link. You should be able to click right here to pre-order your copy of It's Not Hysteria here. So thank you, Karen.
Thank you so much.
All right. So let's get into it. Let's kick things off with endometriosis. So what is it? How do we get diagnosed with it? How do we treat it? Let's lay it on us, Karen.
Fabulous. And so basically every question you just asked has some sort of myth and misinformation attached to it. So basically starting with what is endometriosis? So this is a condition where tissue that looks very similar to the tissue that is normally in the cavity of your uterus called endometrium. So what is normally in your uterus is called endometrium. When something like that grows outside of the uterus is called endometriosis. And basically it's a chronic condition that can cause so many symptoms. It's very inflammatory. So wherever it's near, it inflames. So it can cause a whole wide range of symptoms. So probably the most common things when we think about endometriosis, the symptoms are usually pelvic pain, really painful periods, and pain with sex. But other common symptoms include it can inflame your uterus and cause lots of bleeding, irregular heavy bleeding. It can cause inflammation of the bowels, because the colon, the rectum, the bowels are very close to where endometriosis tends to grow. And so people very commonly have horrible bowel symptoms. So diarrhea, constipation, pain with bowel movements, even blood in the stool, bloating, nausea, vomiting. So a lot of people actually get misdiagnosed as irritable bowel syndrome. Or they might even go to their primary care or a GI doctor before they even think to see a gynecologist, because a lot of people may not put together that my horrible diarrhea is from a gynecologic condition. So they may start with going to see a GI doctor. And actually, for a lot of people, that's the case. It can cause bladder symptoms. It can also cause infertility, because it can inflame and scar the tubes and also cause problems with egg quality. It also causes miscarriage. So sometimes people don't get diagnosed until they're in the middle of a fertility evaluation. Like they've had trouble getting pregnant, they've had recurrent miscarriages, and in the process of trying to figure out why they get diagnosed with endometriosis.
So in terms of typical age of diagnosis, so is this typically something that you see diagnosed later on when folks are thinking about fertility and starting a family?
A lot of people get diagnosed in their 20s. We sort of think about that as kind of the typical age, though most of them start having symptoms pretty much when they have their period. So on average, there's a 7-year delay in diagnosis from the time that someone starts to have symptoms to when they get a diagnosis. And there's a few reasons for that. So number one, the only way to diagnose it is surgically. So there's no imaging study, blood test, pelvic exam that definitely diagnoses it. You have to actually do a laparoscopic surgery. We put a camera in the abdomen and actually literally look inside and then take a specimen of it to, you know, excise it, cut it out. And the pathologist says, yes, that's endometriosis. That's the only way to diagnose it. So obviously not everyone with painful periods is getting a surgery. So very often we think that at least 10% of, you know, girls and women and people assigned female at birth will have endometriosis, but it's probably much higher because so many people don't have surgery. So that's one issue, is that the only way to diagnose is surgical. And then the other is that it's just become such a common misconception that having horrible periods is normal that, you know, people are like, you know, my periods are awful. I'm missing school. I'm missing work. I'm having diarrhea. They get told, well, that's just what periods are like. And so then years go by. And then, like you said, they may not get diagnosed until they're getting a bigger workup for fertility issues, you know, or if they finally get an ultrasound and it shows a big cyst on their ovary, you can get endometriosis cysts that cause a lot of problems. They become, you know, finally big enough to see on imaging studies. So it can oftentimes take a very long time to get diagnosed because of that whole you know, the perfect storm of situations. So,
well, and I don't know if you've been on TikTok lately, Karen, but there's a whole, I don't know, there it's trending right now that there are certain tests for endometriosis, including blood tests. So I just want to confirm for listeners right now, there is no blood test. This is something that requires surgery for diagnosis.
There's a couple of different tests that they're evaluating kind of in research studies. There's nothing that is available or that's like kind of a standard care. So, you know, they've been looking at tests of an endometrial biopsy. So literally taking a sample of the tissue from inside the uterus and or blood tests to evaluate for markers of endometriosis. But none of those is at all available commercially. It's definitely not something that's replaced laparoscopy. And a lot of us who manage endometriosis are kind of like, well, you know, if you have endometriosis, you're having symptoms, you're going to have surgery to treat it anyway. So, you know, the only way to remove it is surgically. So we oftentimes will use, you know, birth control, you know, hormonal medications to try and kind of suppress the symptoms. But the only way to actually remove it is surgically. So that's actually another myth is, you know, like it's treated with birth control. It's not officially treated. It's just sort of, you know, symptom controlled with birth control. And so typically birth control can make your periods less painful and less heavy, but it's not going to make endometriosis disappear. So a lot of us who take care of endometriosis are like, well, this is great, but if you have a concern for endometriosis, we're going to do surgery to try and remove it anyway. Where I've heard that it might be helpful to have that kind of technology is in a place like in the UK, you know, places with really, really long waiting lists for experts, which unfortunately is actually in a lot of parts of the country in the US too. You know, people are waiting like a year to get in with an endometriosis specialist. It might help to triage like who has a strong chance of having endo versus somebody who may have a lower chance. So like I said, it might have its place in the future, but right now it's not something that we're actively using.
So in terms of treatment then, so I heard you say birth control could help manage some of the symptoms, particularly with regard to painful periods, right? Then you mentioned surgery. So can we talk a little bit about what the treatments are for endo and what the outlook looks like for most people who are diagnosed?
Yeah, this is a big issue as well. And so endometriosis in general has a really strong advocacy community, and that's because it has historically been so poorly treated. So, you know, people will have like surgery after surgery after surgery because a lot of times the surgeries may be done by surgeons or general OBGYNs who don't have a lot of experience with it. And it can be very hard surgery. Like, you know, it can cause lots of scarring and inflammation. It can grow right near some of the dangerous structures that we don't want to injure, like the rectum, the ureters, which are tubes that lead urine from your kidney into your bladder. They're very delicate. So a lot of times, you know, general OBGYN who doesn't do a lot of endosurgery may see, oh gosh, there's, you know, some endometriosis spots right on the rectum or right on the ureter. I'm going to leave that in there because I don't want to harm this patient. But then the patient still has pain and then they end up needing more surgeries in the future. So, you know, over the years, the endometriosis community has really become a strong, you know, like the strong advocates for themselves because, you know, they're fed up with this. They're like, well, you know, this is my life. I, you know, I have had to have four surgeries and I still have pain. What's going on? So in terms of the management, just before we kind of get into all of that, just to say that like everything else in gynecology or women's health, there's not amazing studies. Let's just put that out there. Like compared to something like, you know, diabetes, heart disease, we don't have like massive randomized controlled trials with like thousands and thousands of participants. We just don't. There's just not enough funding. There's not enough research attention. And for that reason, a lot of the studies about endometriosis, they tend to be smaller. They tend to be, you know, like some expert in endometriosis has sort of shown a result. So, you know, there's not kind of like that amazing blockbuster kind of research study like you have with, you know, management of high cholesterol or heart disease. So a lot of this comes down to what are the experiences of doctors who do this a lot? And then there are some small studies that basically show that if you cut out the endometriosis, it's called excision, you tend to have lower recurrences and potentially, you know, like less overall, you know, pain afterwards compared to if you just burn it. So there's something called like, you know, ablation, where you just like use heat to destroy it. So the burning is much quicker. Somebody who, you know, isn't sort of as trained in like the really complex excisions and doing a big dissection, you know, may typically do that. But there's been a big groundswell to make sure that people say, like, you know, ask your doctor, like, do they do excision as opposed to ablation? You know, there's not like kind of a hard and fast rule all over, you know, for all situations. Like, I still kind of cauterize, like, if it's on the surface of the uterus, I'm going to burn it because you can't really cut out a chunk of the uterus. So there's exceptions to that rule. But in general, it does kind of help to get a sense of how different doctors approach the same disease. And in general, most of us who are experts will excise it for many reasons. You know, sometimes it grows under the surface. For those who are listening and not seeing this, I'm kind of making like a little like, you know, iceberg motion with my hand. It's kind of like the tip of the iceberg. Like if you just kind of like, you know, just lop off the top, but you're not digging underneath, you're missing a lot of the disease that's under the surface. So it's to make sure that you've gotten all of it out. You know, it's actually safer to cut it out than it is to burn near the rectum and other dangerous structures. You can injure stuff with the heat. So it's actually safer to just use scissors and cut things out. And also you finally, you get a specimen of pathology. Like sometimes it's hard to tell just by looking at a spot if it's endometriosis or not. So getting an actual specimen to send to a pathologist, then you can say, yep, I got a result. It is definitely endometriosis here, here, here. So for all those reasons, most of us who are specialists will tend to excise it and cut it out.
Any other endo myths or misconceptions that you want to address before we move on? I mean, there's so many. We were joking right before. There's so much that we could tackle. I think I have a list of things. I did my homework. I went on TikTok right before this just to see what's really trending so we could address it. But any last thoughts on endo?
Yeah. So one big myth is that hysterectomies treat it. So hysterectomies are surgeries to remove the uterus. So where this myth came from is that there was sort of this old-fashioned theory about how endometriosis comes to be, which is that the actual endometrial tissue from inside your uterus pours backwards out through your tubes when you have your period. And so instead of all going out through the vagina, some of it does, and it's true, some of it does kind of come back out through your tubes and into your abdomen. So you know, this theory came from a couple of different reasons. We won't go into all of, you know, why they thought it happened that way. So the thought is obviously if you get rid of the uterus, you get rid of the source. But that doesn't explain so many cases of endometriosis. So I'll tell you, these are kind of fun facts. Cisgender men get endometriosis. There are case studies where they find it in men. And so they've actually found, yeah, I know, it tends to be men who have higher than normal levels of estrogen. So something about the stimulation from estrogen can make it appear even in cisgender men. And then also you can get it in all sorts of crazy places. Like it's not uncommon to get it in your thorax, like in your pleural space, like between your lung and your chest cavity. You can get it in your belly button. Even if you've never had surgery before, that's actually fairly common. Like we remove not, you know, an insignificant amount of endometriosis in your belly button. And so you obviously get endometriosis in places that don't touch your uterus. So,
obviously it doesn't. Right now.
Yeah. Isn't that great? And also people get endometriosis if they've had a hysterectomy. So you can get it after your uterus is taken out. So again, that's sort of a myth. And unfortunately, that is sometimes still believed by a lot of gynecologists. What is true is that endometriosis is very associated with something called adenomyosis, which is, I call them cousins. So it's like they look fairly similar, but they grew up in different places. So adenomyosis is similar, except it grows in the muscle of the uterus itself. They cause almost the same exact symptoms, except that more bleeding tends to happen with adenomyosis. So if you take do the hysterectomy, you take the uterus out, you do treat adenomyosis. So people do often feel better, but it's not getting rid of or preventing endometriosis. So that's partly, I think, where the myth came about too, is that people did often feel better after hysterectomy, but you're treating a different condition.
How interesting is that? Oh my God. You just blew, I'm sure, many, many of the minds of people listening right now.
I love telling that man fact because people were like, what?
Yeah, who knew?
Who knew?
Yeah. All right. So can I move on to some other
things?
I don't want to do, you know, too rapid fire, or I don't know if that was proper English, but you know what I mean? Because there's just so much. But right before we hit record, I was telling you that I know when I open up my TikTok, for whatever reason, the algorithm is really bringing me a lot about BV, bacterial vaginosis. And for me, what's so unfortunate is that there's quite a bit of shaming. Okay. By the way, let me just give a disclaimer. If you hear noises in the background, I have my dogs in this room. They're attached to me. I can't get rid of them. If you hear Riggan snoring, Klaus is shaking. So I apologize, but okay.
This is like real life. This is
real life, man.
This is not like a sterile, you know, yeah. This is real people, real lives.
I'm recording in my house right now. Right?
Me too.
All right. So BV, bacterial vaginosis, one of the symptoms associated with it, and certainly I'm going to turn to you as the expert on this, but there is an odor that could be associated with it, right? And so on TikTok, unfortunately, there are so many videos just shaming about the odor and recommending that people use boric acid supplements. And of course, many people are selling these supplements.
I was just about to say,
advertisements.
They're selling them.
Calcipres, right? So can you just explain to us, what is bacterial vaginosis? How is it treated? And is there a role, if any, for boric acid?
Yeah, so bacterial vaginosis, or BV, is one of the most common sources of vaginitis or vaginal infection. So it's basically, there's always bacteria in the vagina. That's normal. So it's called the vaginal microbiome. And that bacteria that's normally there is very important for maintaining health. It keeps it at a certain pH, which is acidic, which keeps other types of bacteria and yeast away. So sometimes when that balance shifts, then you get growth of other types of bacteria that then cause different types of infections and discharge. So BV tends to cause the most common symptom is like a discharge with like a fishy odor. So it's not sexually transmitted. Like sometimes there's like myths about, you know, like it's an STD. It's not. It can be associated with moisture. So like, you know, if you are, you know, like having sex, there's a lot of moisture. So, you know, or it's also associated with having your period because of the moisture. But it's not that you got it from a partner. Let's just put it that way. So the treatment is usually antibiotics, like any other infection with a bacteria. So we give either oral or vaginal antibiotics, like a vaginal gel or a cream or oral pills. So BV and yeast do tend to recur a lot. So it's very hard to completely prevent it from coming back. So this is where I think, and I haven't actually seen the TikToks, but, you know, just kind of hearing what you're saying about it. They're sort of preying on the fact that people, if you get infections again, like you're like, oh my God, is there something wrong with me? Is it like that I'm like unclean in some way? So I do kind of hate that they're preying on people in that way, because there's nothing to do with how clean you are or like, you know, your hygiene habits or anything like that. It's just truly just like you get an imbalance of the bacteria and then, you know, you treat it. So it is not uncommon for people to need to either like retreat, you know, several times, or that they'll get infections again. So we do use boric acid suppositories for recurrent BV infections. So if somebody has, you know, like 5 infections, you know, in a year, we'll discuss it to try and minimize the chances of it coming back. So a couple things to know. Boric acid is technically a poison. So it's like, I think it's like rat poison or something like that. So we do tell people, like, make sure you don't ingest it. So partners, like, you know, like oral sex, you know, from a partner right after you use boric acid suppository is a no-no. And it is something, like I said, we don't typically like use it in everyone because, you know, like some people may find it a little bit irritating and that sort of thing. So we only really use it for people who truly need it. Like, you know, you are having a lot of infections in a year. It's definitely not something that everyone with BV needs. You don't need it to maintain your pH, like anything like that. And you know, we've talked a lot about the fact that if someone is like really like scaring everyone on TikTok, look at their profile. Almost certainly they're selling something. They're selling a supplement. They're selling whatever. And I don't know why it is, but like, you know, like the Kardashians are getting into like vaginal pH gummies and all this stuff. I don't know why like people are suddenly like, let's profit off of people's concerns about their, you know, vulva and their vagina. I don't know. But but if you're seeing all this, like, you know, any sort of like, this is something that you are, that the secret is being kept from you and you need to do this for your health. Like, you know, look at their profile. Very often you'll see that link to purchase their boric acid suppositories and stuff.
Well, And the unfortunate thing that I'm seeing with a lot of these posts is, you know, really fear-mongering about antibiotics and how, big pharma is just trying to profit off of the antibiotics. Instead, take the boric acid. And just to be very clear, this is certainly not a replacement for antibiotics.
Right.
It's not treating the bacterial infection, right?
Yeah, we use it for prevention, not to treat the active infection. So, yeah.
Got it. Okay, so let's talk more. There's so much. You know what? We talked, well, just briefly, and it's so funny. Every time I talk about douching, I'm like, what decade are we in? I picture like the 1950s, the ads where it's like, have your dinner ready for your husband, you know, while you're smoking your Philip Morris cigarette. It's like, who is douching? We should not be douching. Can we just talk briefly about people shouldn't be douching?
Speaking of the vaginal microbiome, but yes, so your vagina needs the normal bacteria that's in there. It is actually part of what keeps it healthy. It's part of the defense system of the vagina is to have normal, what's called lactobacilli. Mostly there's several different types, but lactobacilli is the big one that maintain the pH. They keep the other bad bacteria, the yeast, away. So douching actually increases your risk of having like yeast infections and irritation and things like that. So, you know, Jen Gunter is great. You guys had her on, obviously.
Yes.
Like, you know, she wrote the Vagina Bible. There's so much of this very bizarre, like patriarchal, like women are dirty, like just by nature of having a vagina, it's dirty. You got to wash it. You know, like you don't wash like any other, like, you know, you don't wash like your anus or your, you know, like there are certain things that, like,
you're washing your anus in the shower, right?
Right. I was like, you're not like inside, you know what
exactly.
I mean? Like, sorry, yeah, just to clarify, like, you're not washing like inside your rectum, let's put it that way. But, like, you know, that, you wash the outside. So, yeah, to clarify, you wash the outside. So, like, the vulva, like, wash it with water, like, you can use like a fragrance free soap. But like we joke, but it's true. We call the vagina a self-cleaning oven. Like you really don't, you shouldn't like wash inside of it ever. Because also things like soaps and douches and all of those things like can be very irritating. The vagina is very sensitive tissue and, you know, any sort of chemical like that sort of thing can be very irritating and cause like itching and burning. So all of the entire industry of like the summer's eves and like the feminine washes, one, absolutely unnecessary, two, likely to cause harm in some way. So don't do it.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Yeah, it's kind of wild to me. So just as a total aside, and this might be TMI, but even if I use like scented detergents on my underwear, I'll have some sort of irritation. I can't imagine people shoving
inside
some up there.
You know? Oh God. And they all have like, you know, when you look at the faces, it's like Hawaiian sunset and you're like, oh my God, like it just sounds so horrible. I will also say, do not put essential oils on your vulva. I can't tell you.
Pardon?
Like, oh my God. So like lavender or like tea tree oil is caustic. I've had patients come in with like basically burns of their vulva because it's supposed to be like, you know, like cleansing, purifying. I don't know. But yeah, I've had people literally have like vulvar, like first degree burns from like tea tree oil and things. So don't let people tell you that the essential oils are so natural, like put it there and make it smell nice. No, don't put anything like that near your genitals, please. It's horrible. And again, it all kind of comes down to the same ideas. Like you have to make it smell like flowers or purify the dirtiness. Like, no.
Yeah. I cannot really wrap my mind around the fact that people are putting essential oils down there. So thank you for that disclaimer.
Yeah.
All right. Something else that I think we should talk about, it's actually been in the news quite a bit lately, is the HPV vaccine. And the reason it's been in the news is because there's even more data, more research showing how highly effective it is, how amazing it is at preventing cervical cancer. So, Karen, one of the things I'm sure you hear quite a bit is that the HPV vaccine will somehow encourage promiscuity. So do you want to talk about this? Can we just let's
talk
chat
about
the
that.
HPV
yeah.
vaccine?
Exactly. So just kind of like, you know, the whole big picture. So cervical cancer, almost 100% of cervical cancers is caused by human papillomavirus, which is sexually transmitted. And it's a very common virus, like something like, you know, like 75% of people who are sexually active will have some type of HPV at some point. It's not about, you know, again, there's sort of this shame associated with it, like, oh, you know, it's like only people who are promiscuous will get that. You know, like that, I don't need that for my child because they're not going to be promiscuous. So they don't even need it anyway. But if anybody has any sort of sexual activity with any human partner, they're going to get exposed to HPV. That's almost a given. So the vaccine and the type that we have in the US now covers 9 strains of HPV. It doesn't cover all of them. So you still need to get your screening with your pap smears because, you know, there are some types of HPV that aren't covered that can cause cervical precancer and cancers. But it's extremely, extremely effective. So we think it's like, you know, something like, you know, like 99% effective at avoiding cancers. And actually, the data just out of Scotland, they basically had 0 cervical cancers in the group that was vaccinated. So just saying, like, it's enormously effective. And it's also extremely safe. So like something like hundreds of millions of doses have been administered, and there's no significant, you know, major side effects. The most common ones are just like any other vaccine where you can have like some soreness of the arm, or you can feel faint. But no like long-term effects. So definitely no long-term effects on fertility. That's a big myth that is going to like make you infertile. I don't know where that came from. You know, so it's not going to impact your long-term health. It doesn't cause, you know, autism. Like I'm sure you covered this ad nauseum.
Yes.
But yeah, there's this whole like something about the fact that it's sexually transmitted. It invites all of this discussion about promiscuity, that if you think you're protected from HPV, it's going to make you use less caution and be more promiscuous and feel like you can have sex willy-nilly. Let's just say that the vaccine is administered to, like, you know, prepubescent children, to, like, you know, children who are, you know, before the age that most are sexually active. That's the whole concept, is to protect them before they have any sexual exposures. So, you know, my kids, my 2 older girls, like as soon as they were old enough, got that vaccine. I promise you, they're not like, woohoo, we're going to have all the sex now. Just like absurd.
It is absurd.
And so when you think about it, it's like, it's a cancer vaccine. Imagine if there was like a breast cancer vaccine, like how many people would like rush to get it? And it prevents almost 100% of that cancer. And so be like, you know, I don't think I'm going to get to my kids because like, they're not going to be like out there sleeping around. I mean, it's crazy.
Totally.
Yeah.
And you know, that's such a good point. I think we honestly need to start framing it as a cancer vaccine because it is preventing
that's
cancer.
What it is.
That is what it's doing. And by the way, and I've shared this before, I had HPV. Luckily, you know, there were precancerous cells. I had to go through more rigorous screening over time. I've since been cleared. I wish I had received the HPV vaccine.
Yeah.
A few things. So it is authorized for use through age 45, although you have to check with your insurance provider because sometimes they won't cover it after a certain age. I think usually 26 is typically a, you know, sometimes they won't cover it after 26. It is for both men and women.
Yes.
It is, you can and should consider getting it even if you're in a monogamous relationship, because guys, I'm sorry to break it to you, but you know, stuff happens and better to be safe than sorry. And then also, even if you've had HPV, you can consider getting the vaccine because, as you said, it protects against various strains. And so you may have had one strain, but this can protect you against other strains.
Yes. So. Yeah. And actually, a very good point that it is for not just girls. It's encouraged that, you know, boys, girls, like all genders get it because, you know, one, it decreases the amount of HPV in the whole community, which helps everyone. But HPV also causes oral cancers, which there has definitely been, I think, a rise in oral cancers, you know, anal cancers, penile cancers. Those are much more rare than cervical cancer, but why not prevent them?
why
not prevent a preventable cancer. So definitely. Yeah. And then the age is actually important because it used to be that they were only covering up to age 25, but because it is now FDA approved for, you know, up to age 45. And women, I'm not sure about men, but like definitely for women, but not every insurance company will cover it. But it's still worth it, especially, you know, if you aren't in the only relationship you'll ever be in for the rest of your life until you pass away. Like, you know, if there's any conceivable future exposure to HPV, it's still worth getting.
And even if you think you're with the person you'll be with for the rest of your life.
I'm sorry.
I hate to say that, but just thinking back to my early 20s, how sure I was, you know? Anyway, sorry. And honestly, if you're watching this on video right now, I'm like full Ace Ventura moment. I have all my dogs on top of me. You might hear my dog Rudy's crying in the back. No, I am so sorry for folks who hear this and see. Okay, well, thank you. All right, let's move on, Karen. So, what about birth control?
Birth control,
Can we
Let's
talk about that?
Do
because
it.
People are saying that it's causing cancer. Is that true?
Oh my God. So we were saying, birth control is fully under attack from various sources right now. So, and the reasons it's under attack is very different depending on who is saying it. So obviously the most kind of high profile very recently was Elon Musk. So he had this bizarre tweet where he said that, I don't even know what the background to him saying this, it sort of came out of nowhere. He was like, birth control makes you fat and makes you suicidal. And he says that like scientists agree and basically said that, you know, the scientific community is like hiding this. So the background of this is, I made a video about this. It's not that people thought, oh, isn't it so great? He's speaking up for the women. He's not speaking up for the women. Like he apparently is some sort of like, I don't know why, but he thinks that the world is like underpopulated. And so the population needs to increase. And so he's basically telling everyone to go out and get pregnant. And let's just say, and when we talk about risks and this is the scientific way to think about things, you don't just talk about the risk of the thing. You have to talk about the risk of the alternative. So if you say we're on reliable birth control and happy with it, but you're like, oh, I'm so scared. Elon Musk scared me. And you stop your birth control and you get pregnant. Pregnancy has so much more risk of basically every single thing. So any side effect of birth control, you know, let's just say gaining weight, we'll talk about that in a moment. Mood changes, blood clots. Pregnancy is a far higher risk of every single one of those. So just to kind of say in a vacuum, and this is what happens on TikTok and social media all the time. People be like, birth control is horrible. Like it makes you gain weight. It makes you like feel terrible and have like all sorts of mood problems. I always say like any conceivable side effect, if you get pregnant, is far worse. And that includes risk of death. That's why there's a maternal mortality issue. You know, Black maternal mortality is a crisis because pregnancy is not a risk neutral situation. It's very, you know, in some situations, it's quite dangerous. So
absolutely,
just kind of, you know, framing it in that way. The other kind of thing is that genuinely people do get side effects, some of them from birth control. It is a medication. It's a hormonal medication. Like some people do have significant mood symptoms, depression, anxiety. The study data on weight gain is that the only birth control method that does significantly, statistically significantly increase risk of weight gain is Depo-Provera, the injection. On paper, in a population, the other birth control methods do not have a significant increased risk. Now, that doesn't mean, I always tell people, that does not mean that your individual risk is zero. It just means that, you know, if someone gains weight and another person, you know, like loses weight, like it sort of evens out. So the same thing for mood, because a lot of people on birth control feel better because they're treating their PMS, their PMDD, and they're actually using the birth control as a treatment for those mood disorders and mood conditions, you know, like they felt better, you know, somebody who, you know, felt worse, it like almost like kind of like evens out to be a net neutral. So I always tell people just because on paper and statistics and all of that, like, you know, there's not a significant increased risk, that doesn't mean that your, you know, likelihood is not, you know, is zero. It's not to negate all the experiences of the people who do have side effects. For sure, people do. But what has happened is that people have kind of taken like those individual experiences and the fact that, you know, like no birth control is like perfect for every single person. Like there's a lot of personalization that we do. Like we ask people what their concerns are. what fits their lifestyle best in terms of, you know, how often do they have to take something? And we have to kind of customize the decision for that person. But what's happened is that in social media, you lose the nuance, which is like in every topic. It becomes like just like birth control makes everyone feel X and it's dangerous for everyone. So then people are like, oh my God, like it's all dangerous. Whereas, you know, you have to kind of like look at the risks and benefits. So blood clots and cancer. So these are two things that like, somebody just sent me a video where they're like, it gives you cancer, it gives you blood clots. So again, let's just talk about each of those things.
Yeah.
The overall risk of cancer when you take birth control is lower. You have a lower risk of cancer if you take birth control because it decreases your risk of uterine and ovarian cancer. So it protects your uterus and your ovaries against cancer. So your overall cancer risk is lower. And we give birth control for people for suppression of those risks. In fact, we even give for people with the BRCA mutation who have a higher risk of breast and ovarian cancer, birth control, because one, you know, if they don't want to be pregnant. Number two is it decreases their ovarian cancer risk. So, you know, even someone who does have a higher than average risk of breast cancer, we do talk to them about, you know, options for hormonal birth control. We don't say that you're not allowed to take it. So the breast cancer risk is very slightly elevated with pretty much all, including like the IUDs, which it's a little hard to kind of imagine why, but you know, that, you know, in kind of Scandinavian studies, they did show like a small increased risk, but the actual risk is like a few and many thousands. And in general, like when you come off of the birth control, that risk does tend to kind of go back to what it would otherwise have been. So it's not like kind of like a permanent long-term risk. And again, the actual amount is far less than 1%. It does also increase, you know, breast cancer risk increases naturally when you get older. So it is something that we revisit. Somebody's like, you know, in their late 30s, 40s, you know, and they don't need birth control. You know, the husband got a vasectomy. Like, obviously, we'll, you know, say, like, do you want to stop it? Like, we always kind of like individualize that counseling. So again, mm-hmm. in real life, doctors are talking to an individual patient about, here are your options. Here's the pluses and minuses. Like, what do you want to do? It's not like, everybody don't do this.
You know? So, right. Yeah. Right.
And then the blood clot risk is also extremely small, but we do tailor that. So if somebody has higher risks of blood clots, you know, they have high blood pressure, they have a family history, they have a clotting disorder, then we may avoid, say, the estrogen containing birth control, which is where the risk actually comes from. You know, but again, you know, if someone with a clotting disorder gets pregnant, their risk of clots is far higher. So we want to prevent pregnancy if they don't want to be pregnant. So again, we have to kind of take that nuanced look at it. And then back to the, you know, why are people doing this on TikTok? Again, look at their profile. Chances are the ones that are most vocal about like, this is horrible. It's like killing you. It's ruining your body. Like doctors are, you know, terrible liars. Like if you look at their profile, I guarantee you almost 100% of the time, they're selling a supplement, a course. There's a lot of these like dudes who are on TikTok. Have you seen these with like the shirtless and the carnivores and like mm-hmm. meat supplements and stuff like that? They are, they love to talk crap about birth control. Mm-hmm. Like their meat supplement is going to keep you from getting pregnant, but somehow they're like,
of course it will.
You know, it's horrible. So look at kind of why they're trying to create that fear. And we always say like doctors, like, you know, we don't get paid any differently. Like if you choose birth control or not, like, you know, we have no skin in the game. Like if you, mm-hmm. if you don't want to be on birth control, that's absolutely fine. Like it's not for everyone, but mm-hmm. you know, neither are we saying that, you know, like you should always be on birth. You should always be on this type of treatment. If someone's
exactly.
like, I have the, you know, I have the only secret that will detox your body from the birth control that ruined it.
Warning.
There's warning signs, warning signs all over the place. Yeah,
exactly. But you hit the nail on the head. And that's exactly what I was going to say is that, yeah, you know, we base, it's very important to keep in mind certain, you know, research studies that are conducted at the population level. But at the end of the day, your individual healthcare provider has to weigh your personal medical history and risks. You know, if you're very high risk for breast cancer or mm-hmm. whatever it is, you know, mm-hmm. then maybe maybe it's not for you. But these are not things, as you said, that can be just generalized in a very black and white, all or none fashion, as they often are in social media. So the last thing I'm hoping we could talk about, and we're obviously we have to have you back on because we could
talk
for 10 more hours,
yeah,
is PCOS. Is that mm-hmm. polycystic ovary syndrome? Is yeah. that right? Is that
yeah,
what it
is? Yeah, polycystic ovarian syndrome.
Mm-hmm. Ovarian syndrome. Sorry. Yeah. So what is that? It is all over. I'm seeing it all over TikTok. Can we talk mm-hmm. about what it is and maybe chat about some of the myths that are circulating about it?
Oh, yeah. PCOS is a very interesting condition. So it is actually the most common endocrine or hormone condition in reproductive age women. And it's a little sad that, like, you know, like people are like, what is that? I'm like, it's only the most common endocrine condition of reproductive. So I think it affects like 10% of women. And it's, again, this is where it's a very nebulous condition. It's not like a disease state where there's like one enzyme or one mutation. It's a grouping of symptoms. So that's why the syndrome part comes in. So you don't even need to have polycystic ovaries to have polycystic ovarian syndrome. So it's actually a very poorly named condition. And a lot of people are trying to say that it should be renamed because it kind of makes no sense. So it basically comes down to, do you have 2 out of 3 symptoms or signs? So one is like missing or very infrequent periods. 2 is signs of elevated testosterone hormone. So like what we typically think of as male hormone, but you know, like everyone of any gender has testosterone, it's just different levels of it. So if you have higher than normal female levels of testosterone and or signs of that, like excess facial or body hair, acne. And then the third, you know, possible sign is seeing lots of tiny little cysts on ultrasound of the ovaries. So these are not like big cysts. They're basically just follicles or where the eggs are developing. So you would see like these little tiny specks. We call them like pearls on a string. So you literally see like all these little tiny black dots, you know, on the ovary. The problem with PCOS is that it's a hormone imbalance that keeps you from ovulating regularly. So the high testosterone, you know, it basically throws off, you know, some of the signaling. And so you don't necessarily ovulate every single month. And then you get all these little follicles, which kind of like line up. So it's also highly, highly associated with what we call metabolic conditions like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and diabetes or insulin resistance or prediabetes. So it is a very complex condition. It's, and like I said, the what people experience and the type of symptoms and findings that they have is very different person to person. So I and a lot of people think that it's actually probably several different conditions that just sort of have gotten lumped into this one, just for lack of better categorization or like better like diagnostic information. Like maybe there are like genes or markers that do exist. It's just we just don't know about them yet. So like these kind of relatively similar things have gotten all plopped into the one condition. So I wouldn't be surprised if down the line we actually do kind of separate out, you know, the people with the more metabolic issues are different from the people who have more of like, you know, like the acne and the facial hair issues, you know. So it is this very kind of big melting pot of different things that can go on. It's a very common cause of fertility difficulties because if you're not releasing eggs regularly, it's obviously harder to get pregnant. So among people who are going through infertility, it's a relatively common condition.
Okay. And then how is it treatable or managed? Is there a hormonal treatment? How do we treat PCOS?
Yeah. And so, you know, I say this in my book a lot, like, you know, many of the chapters in the book say, well, since we don't know exactly what causes it, there's no way to directly treat the cause. So, you know, things like, you know, blood pressure medications for hypertension, like they will have a specific function on, say, like blood vessels or on like, you know, like fluid balances. You know, like there's something about like we know kind of where this problem is coming from so we can directly treat it. So PCOS, because it is so nebulous, like there's not like an official like PCOS treatment. I'm making the air quotes. We basically manage the symptoms. So for instance, like if someone has a lot of acne, facial hair, we treat that, you know, with like you see the dermatologist. There's something called spironolactone, which is a medicine for acne, also drops testosterone levels. If somebody's having difficulty getting pregnant, there are medications to induce ovulation. And for those who are overweight, because it is associated with being overweight or obese, for those who are overweight or obese, losing, you know, some weight can sometimes normalize the hormone imbalances. Now, the caveat is we always tell people, because there's sort of this myth that you have to like lose X pounds and things like that. It's never that. So, you know, it sort of has gotten misinterpreted in like, you know, the treatment of PCOS is lose 20 pounds. It's not. It's about sort of like overall health and to manage things like the risk of the high cholesterol and the risk of the diabetes, you know, in addition to kind of just like overall wellness. So like I said, we sort of approach it in that way. It's kind of piecemeal. It depends on what the person's going through and what their symptoms or concerns are.
How interesting is that? Karen, yeah. I learned so much from you today.
Oh, thank you.
Are there any last thoughts, or is there a particular myth or something that you wish that we had covered that we haven't, or do you feel like we've covered a lot of ground?
We covered a lot. Yeah.
We covered a lot.
So in addition to the, if someone is saying something on social media that it just sounds so scary and so, you know, like you've been lied to, that, you know, people are hiding this, like, again, look and see what their conflict of interest is, because there usually is one. Like they have some reason that they're trying to scare you. And then the other is just the bigger picture of, you know, we talked about like with the title of the book, It's Not Hysteria. At the other extreme is if you're going through something and you feel like you're not being taken seriously, you're not getting an answer from your doctor, they're telling you this is normal and you should just sort of suck it up. And that could be anything. And, you know, it could be endometriosis type pain or period pain. It could be perimenopause, menopause. If you're like, I feel like I'm going crazy, like I can't sleep, you know, my mood is off, like, you know, I've gained all this weight. Like, so like, you know, all of these like kind of nebulous symptoms, if you're kind of being I just did a podcast earlier today in the UK and they kept saying fobbed off. So I love that. I was like, if you're being fobbed off
I love that.
By your doctor, I was like, I'm going to steal that. And you're not getting answers, you know, it's almost certainly not in your head. So try and get a second opinion. So, you know, try and see a specialist. Oftentimes, you know, someone who sees a PCOS specialist, an endometriosis specialist, will get a lot more of a nuanced answer. If you're like, I kind of feel like my doctor is ignoring me or really not listening to my concerns, or they only present like one option. So, you know, birth control, say, like if they're only saying your one option is birth control, there's no other options, take it or leave it, that is definitely a reason to get a second opinion for someone who perhaps maybe specializes in that issue more. So like I said, it's sort of the two extremes of all the things we're talking about, both kind of on the medical establishment and like the, you know, the chiropractor selling supplements on TikTok. So in either direction, just, you know, like, use your spidey senses. Like, think about, you know, does this sit right with me? Like, you can always with doctors get a second opinion if you're like, I feel like I'm kind of not getting the answers that I need.
Right. Well, okay. Maccabee, 7.
The dog's like, wrap it up.
Unbelievable. Yeah, wrap it up, people. All right. Well, I hope you found this interesting and you enjoyed walking through these topics with us today. Definitely be sure to follow Dr. Karen Pang at Karen Pang MD on TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube. Be sure to pre-order a copy of her book, It's Not Hysteria, Everything You Need to Know About Your Reproductive Health, But We're Never Told. And again, we will link to all of this in our show notes. In the meantime, I'll continue to share infographics to the Unbiased Science social media channels. Be sure to give a follow at Unbiased SciPod. It would also be super helpful if you would take a minute to leave a written review on Apple or wherever you're tuning in. If you're watching on YouTube, hello, be sure to subscribe to the Unbiased Science channel. Remember, there's also a Substack newsletter. It's free to subscribe, but if you're willing and able, paid subscriptions are much appreciated. Sincere thanks for tuning in and following along as we share no nonsense, just science.
I am a scientist.